So are you ready?
Yep.
All right. Samantha McClinchy, McClinchey, McClinchy. She bought $20 worth of candy from the Jackson Candy and Fudge Factory over there on the corner of Elm and East Michigan Avenue. And there were a total of 133 entries. A little fewer this week. But, yeah, congratulations. Samantha McClinchy won $1,000.
Way to go, Samantha. You had way over 500 entries, though, all told, I think.
Yeah, I think we were averaging about 200 entries, so that'd be about 750, roughly.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's all good. It's all good.
Yeah.
And next year, hopefully we'll be able to run it again. And next year, hopefully we aren't dealing with COVID and there's a lot more stores open and the world is a brighter place.
Yes.
Yep. So congratulations, Samantha McClinchy. Bought $20 worth of candy from the Jackson Candy and Fudge Factory on the corner of Elm and East Michigan Avenue.
It's a beautiful thing.
Thank you to all our local retailers for being there for everyone to shop at this Christmas season. Anyhow. All right. So now on to the show. I thought it might be kind of interesting to talk about this past year and what changed as a result of COVID or something that happened within the year and what we thought might stick. Kind of like, Bill, do you think the remote notarization will stay in place?
I hope so. It's supposed to expire, I think, on the 31st, but I'm hoping that it gets extended. At least I think it expired on the 31st. I'll have to double-check the statute. So I hope that continues. And then last evening, the president folded on his threat to not sign the most recent COVID-19 bill, and that does contain an additional moratorium on evictions through January 31. It had already been extended by the CDC, its order, but this particular statute does provide eviction relief through the 31st. It also provides $25 billion in subsidies for tenants that's to be distributed through the states and local municipalities.
You know, talking about tenants and evictions, I've had a couple calls in the last week or so about tenants who have abandoned their units and how the landlord enter the unit if they perceive it to be abandoned, and what's the process for that? Can you shed some light on it for me?
Yeah, actually, I've got a deal going on right now up in Brighton, and the tenant is there. Tenant hasn't paid rent. My client bought the property earlier this month and didn't have a lawyer. They didn't transfer the security deposit, and it's a fairly large security deposit. They didn't do an assignment of the lease. The person that bought it wants to get the tenant out and wants to move into the place. And so now we're in the middle of a bit of a mess because the tenant doesn't want to move, so we're having to deal with this. I did get an email yesterday that the tenant is being a little more cooperative, but one of the issues is going to be if they actually move out, but they don't give notice that they're moving out. In other words, the landlord sees that there's nothing in there, but the tenant hasn't given formal notice. Has the property been vacated by the tenant? So my view is I want to, in every possible case, I want to get an email or a note or something from the tenant that says the tenant has vacated the property. I don't want to just do it on a visual inspection, although sometimes it has to be that way. And the tenant moves out, doesn't give any notice to the landlord, doesn't give any keys. And so the landlord's now caught sort of between a rock and a hard place, because if they move in, but the tenant then claims that they haven't vacated, they were just in the process of moving, but they hadn't moved, and so they were still there, then the landlord has made an illegal entry under the statute, the statute which prohibits that kind of entry, prohibits the landlord from doing anything to interfere with the occupancy of the tenant. So it's a real issue.
Well, so if they know that they're not there, what do they do?
Well, what I would do is I'd put a notice on the door, say, hey, look, this notice, something to the effect that the property appears abandoned. If you have not abandoned the property, you need to let us know. Also send them an email. Presumably you've got an email address that the statute, the Truth in Renting Statute, Landlord-Tenant Relationship Act allows the parties in the lease to agree that notices can be served by email. And so the lease form for a landlord should contain that provision, so that now I have the ability to email the tenant and say, hey, look, you know, are you out? If you're not out, you need to let me know. I'll give you 24 hours, 48 hours to let me know. And at that point, the landlord has to be pretty certain, if everything's been moved out, there are no cars there, nothing's happened, then the landlord is, my view is the landlord takes over just for the protection of the property, if nothing else. But again, you run a risk if you go in there too early thinking that, in fact, they have abandoned when they are vacated when they haven't, in fact, vacated. I mean, that's an issue.
But if they gave me a security deposit and they don't give me a forwarding address and they've abandoned it, what happens to that security deposit?
I don't like to call it abandoned. They vacated. They, you know, that you abandon property that you own. You don't really abandon a property that you rent. You vacate, and if they haven't given a forwarding address, then the landlord is relieved of compliance with the Landlord-Tenant Relationship Act, which is also the Security Deposit Act. So they have to give you the forwarding address. If they give you the forwarding address, now you got to comply with that act. And if you want to retain any portion of the security deposit for unpaid rent and for damages to the premises, you now have to go through the process of sending the notice to the tenant of what the claim damages are. The tenant then has a period of time limited. And these time periods are very short. The tenant has a limited period of time to object. If the tenant objects, then the landlord has to file a summary proceeding. Serve it on the tenant. Tenant then provides an answer, and you're now in the district court. But the time limits for the landlord to comply with all this stuff are very, very short.
Right. And doesn't the tenant have to give the landlord the forwarding address within 4 days after vacating the property?
Yeah, they have to give it within a prescribed period of time. I can't remember if it's within 4 days. I'd have to. I can check on that very quickly if you want.
I'm certain it's 4 days because it's in our lease. But,
well, then the landlord only has a limited time period of time in which to notify the tenant of what the damages are.
30 days.
Hold on.
Matt, it's 30 days.
Don't say 30. I'd want to check the statute, okay?
All right, well, you check, and we'll see if I'm right. in the meantime, what else has happened? In real estate, I'm finding a lot more of my transactions are online, as far as once someone has determined the house that they want to buy or if they want to list their property. I'm finding that we do Dotloop, which is an electronic signing. We fill in the form and then they electronically sign it. I think that will stick around. It's kind of like in 2009 and 10 when the economy tanked and before you showed a house, you had to prove that the person could get lending for purchasing. And then we started including letters with all our purchase agreements showing proof of the ability to finance. That changed during that time frame. I'm seeing us kind of go towards more of the electronic format of real estate as far as signing documents.
And a record low interest rates. I did a closing a week ago Friday, and the title company wouldn't use remote notary and wouldn't, and they were not holding closings in house. So this is a really large, multi-million-dollar commercial closing, and the title company over in the Detroit metro area, they weren't doing closings in house in person, and they weren't set up to do remote notary, so we had to scramble around to get this closing done, and it had to be done a week ago Friday.
Bill, what about general court business now that is it's gone online? What do you think about that?
Yeah, so far I have yet to have a judge conduct a trial. I've got a couple federal court cases. They're not holding any trials. Everything's been pushed off. They're only doing emergency matters. I'm sure they're doing some criminal trials, but how they're doing them, I don't know. In the circuit courts, nothing is being conducted in person in any of the several I've got circuit court proceedings in Oakland, Macomb, Chippewa County, Marquette. But nobody's doing any in-person stuff. We're all doing it via Zoom.
Do you think there'll be in the future an ongoing that more court will be held online via Zoom, or do you think that will go back to normal?
I hope it does, because let me give you an example. If I have a case in Oakland County, which is one of the worst, Wednesday morning is motion day for every single judge in Oakland County. And so what happens is Wednesday morning, it's like a cattle yard with lawyers sitting around in all these courtrooms, and all of our meters are running because, you know, we charge from portal to portal when we leave the office and when we get back. And so, I can tell you of a case I had in Oakland County that is just unbelievable, where we went back six separate Wednesdays waiting for this particular judge to call our case, and he could never get through his docket. And so my client gets billed for every time I'm sitting there in that courtroom waiting. As opposed to Zoom, now what happens is you get put in a waiting room. If your hearing is at 10 o'clock, for example, you get put in a waiting room, and then if the court's busy, they'll just let you know when your case is ready to be called. In the meanwhile, you can be working on something else. You don't have to travel to the court. And you know, as you know, my practice is all over the state. It's not just in Jackson County. And so I've got travel time. So now I don't have to travel, so I don't have to charge the client travel time. And I don't have to charge the client for sitting around in a courtroom waiting for my case to be called. It's absolutely phenomenal. And I think that the Michigan Supreme Court Administrator's Office is going to adopt a plan which allows courts to continue doing Zoom hearings other than trials. Now, I'm actually equipped to do a non-jury trial. I could do it, but a lot of courts are not really too... They're not as technologically savvy. They're a little concerned about how they handle evidence, documentary evidence, testimony. And a lot of it, you know, when you take testimony, you want to see the witness. You know, you want the witness to be in front of you so you can see what their mannerisms are, whether they're fidgeting, all that sort of stuff. So trials, I think, are going to be conducted in person once this pandemic is through.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I love it. I mean, you know, I can sit here. Now, some courts demand that if you're on a Zoom hearing that the lawyer have a coat and tie on, et cetera. I have a great headshot that I can, with a coat and tie on, that I can put up on the screen, but it's not me in person. It's just the headshot. And some courts allow that.
When you're in person, do they require a coat and tie?
Absolutely.
Do they really? Huh.
Yeah, okay, so why do you think I wear a coat and tie to the court?
Well, I just, because you're a smart guy, you know, and that's part of the whole intimidation.
Oh, come on, in the old days, I can tell you about two judges in Oakland County where, one in particular, this is back in the 70s and early 80s, where the judge, if you were a male attorney, you had to wear a blue or a white shirt, no stripes, and it had to be a suit, no sport jacket and slacks. And if you were a woman, I saw this judge kick a woman, a female lawyer, out of court because she wasn't wearing a swearing suit.
Wow.
In the 70s, mid-70s.
That wouldn't fly in today's world.
It would not fly at all. Okay?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But the court does demand that you be reasonably dressed. I don't know. I guess there are some lawyers that show up a little sloppy in court. You know, that I guess that happens, but any reputable lawyer is going to wear a coat and tie. Not necessarily a suit, but at least a coat and tie in court. And in federal court, you'll be wearing a suit. You're not going to show up in a sport jacket and khakis.
Right. Well, they don't dictate what we wear in real estate, so that's all good.
But you always want to dress appropriately for what
Absolutely.
You're doing.
Absolutely. One of the things that's happening in real estate is right now is the title companies are so slammed because procedures they have to follow as a result of COVID. So the agents can't attend the closings. So I'm hoping that doesn't stay because I like being there. I like being there for my clients in case they have any questions or concerns about what's going on.
And personally, I prefer that you not be. But let me also tell you one of the real issues right now is if I'm a purchaser of property, I don't want to close this year unless I've got some tax reason. If I whatever that tax reason may be, or because it's the deadline for 1031 exchange. But if I delay my closing till after January 1, what happens is now my taxes don't get uncapped until the following year. So from a purchaser's point of view, I don't want to have the closing this year. But from a seller's point of view, particularly with the change in administrations and the fear that capital gains taxes are going to go up, I've got clients that have been scrambling to get their sales closed before the end of the year. So you've got those two competing interests there.
I was just kind of reading up to see what's going to happen next year. And the low interest rates are predicted. I think we'll still see a low inventory of properties to sell. So the recommendation is going to be that if you decide to put your house on the market, you need to know where you're going. You need to know that your house is going to sell quickly if it's priced right. And actually, Jackie had a friend that bought a house, sold her house, you know, probably I'm just using rough numbers because it was up north a little bit, for about 225, and because interest rates were so low, she got a bigger house with the same payment that she had, and she paid $450 for the house that they bought. So the market is going to allow people to upgrade their housing or get into a house because they can now afford it because interest rates are so low.
One minute, Laura.
Okay. However, sellers need to know where they're going to go because it's going to be tough to find a house to buy. It's going to be that simple. And with that note, then...
hey, happy New Year, Greg.
You too, Bill.
I just want to do a final congratulations to Samantha McClinchy, who won $1,000 from the Shop Small Win Big, and thank you to all the sponsors of that that program, which was Consumers Energy, Consumers Financial Credit Union, Anchor Initiative, Thinking Real Estate, the Jackson Downtown Development, Loom, and the Chamber, along with the Experience Jackson. Without their support, we could not have run that program. And if anybody wants help with buying or selling real estate, I hope you give me a call, Laura Schlechte, Thinking Real Estate, 780-3800, and Happy New Year.